Launch Complex 39A at the John F. Kennedy Space Center is on a threshold. Located on Merritt Island off the east coast of Florida, it is positioned where the land meets the sea, the salty wind sighing across the flat and marshy mainland. The waves crashing along the shore conspicuously demonstrate the contrast between the untamed ocean and the comprehensible land. However, on November 9th, 1967, another border was established at this geographic boundary when NASA launched the unmanned Apollo 4 spacecraft carried by a Saturn V rocket into Earth orbit from the launch pad, establishing the site as a portal to the heavens. Throughout the second half of the 20th century and the first decade of the 21st, this new threshold became well-worn as Americans took their first steps out into the stars, beginning with Alan Shepard's first flight into space in 1961, and continuing throughout the duration of the space shuttle program. But when the shuttle program ended in 2011, and with it the nation's capacity to send its own astronauts into orbit, America's doorway to space seemed to abruptly close, propped open only by unmanned missions to resupply the International Space Station. As any good historian knows, history is a living, breathing story. Something that gains new meaning as time progresses. Such was the case on April 14th, 2014, when a private company called Space Exploration Technologies, SpaceX for short, signed a 20-year lease with NASA for Launch Complex 39A, bringing the launch pad roaring back to life 6 years later on May 30th, 2020, when the company launched two American astronauts into space and delivered them to the International Space Station, becoming the first private entity ever to do so. Taking place amid the coronavirus pandemic, the historic SpaceX launch, and a subsequent mission the following November, indicate that the country's gateway to the cosmos has been energetically reopened, straddling the boundary between past and future as a new era of spaceflight emerges from the private sector. And the driving force behind this new age of space exploration, a controversial but undeniably successful entrepreneur named Elon Musk, has his sights set on a lofty but increasingly feasible goal. Taking mankind to Mars. I'm Nate Ray, writer for The Donut, and this is the Rocket Launch Pod.
OTC is go.
Pegasus is go.
PTC is go.
HPS is go.
Houston flight is go.
Mile is go.
STM is go.
Safety comms is go.
STU is go.
LRD is go.
SRO is go.
CDI is go.
Launch director NTD, our launch team is ready to proceed at this time.
Ignition sequence start. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, liftoff. Liftoff on Apollo 11.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things. Not because they are easy, but because they are hard.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
This is Houston, say again, please.
Houston, we've had a problem.
The crew of the Space Shuttle Challenger honored us with the manner in which they lived their lives. We will never forget them, nor the last time we saw them.
Liftoff, Americans return to space as Discovery clears the tower.
It's gone, the shuttle, and that those aboard it could not have and did not survive.
Booster ignition and liftoff of Endeavour, completing Kibo and fulfilling Japan's hope for an out-of-this-world space laboratory.
Ignition. Liftoff of the Falcon 9 and Crew Dragon. Go NASA, go SpaceX, Godspeed, bottom dog.
The year was 2002, and a 31-year-old Elon Musk was worried. Born in South Africa, Musk fled to Canada at age 17 to avoid compulsory military service in his home country, and attended Queen's University in Ontario for 2 years before transferring to the University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, where in 1997 he earned bachelor's degrees in physics and economics. He then briefly enrolled in a graduate program in physics at the University of Stanford in California, dropping out after just 2 days. Why the short tenure? To Musk, the internet offered more tantalizing opportunities to change the world than physics. What followed was a swift and lucrative tour through the tech industry as America experienced the dot-com boom. Having founded a company called Zip2, which licensed maps and business directories to online newspapers in 1995, The young Musk sold the business in 1997 to a computer manufacturer for $307 million. For his next venture, Elon founded X.com, an online bank that later became PayPal. In 2002, eBay bought PayPal for $1.5 billion, netting Musk $180 million. So there Elon Musk was, already fabulously wealthy and yet not satisfied. In fact, he was terrified. The reason? 4 years earlier, an international body of astronomers had warned that an asteroid, known officially as Asteroid 1997 XF11, had the potential to hit Earth on October 26, 2028, a Thursday. The effects of the impact would be devastating on a global scale. The collision of the asteroid, estimated to be a half mile in diameter, could cause tidal waves, continent-sized fires, and an eruption of dust into the atmosphere that could result in global cooling and agricultural disruption. Fortunately, after conducting a thorough analysis of the asteroid's orbit, scientists at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, concluded that such a collision would not occur, and in fact was close to impossible. Still, Musk anguished, even without an asteroid impact in 2028, there was still the possibility of a global catastrophe wiping out the human race. It was only a matter of time, he figured, before some other heavenly body arrived to reckon with life on Earth. By confining ourselves to this planet, we were putting all of our eggs in one basket. There was no hard drive for the human race. And so, on May 6th, 2002, Elon Musk incorporated SpaceX with the mission of making humans a multiplanetary species. First stop, Mars.
Discovery Houston, 20 seconds to LOS Tedris.
Project, nice to be in orbit.
So, why Mars? If you've ever seen a picture of the surface of Mars, a red, dusty expanse apparently devoid of any organic material, you know that the planet is by no means Earth-like. And it isn't. To start, the red planet is less than half the size of the Earth, sporting only 38% of our home planet's gravitational pull. Translation, if you can jump 3 feet high on Earth, you could jump almost 9 feet directly upwards on Mars. Next, the Martian atmosphere is, to put it lightly, quite a bit different than the one we're used to. On Earth, our bodies are conditioned to a relatively thick atmosphere pushing down against us with 15 pounds of pressure at all times. The Martian atmosphere, on the other hand, is 100 times thinner than the Earth's, meaning an unprotected human body would be pulled apart by lack of pressure. The Martian atmosphere is also 96% carbon dioxide, compared to 0.04% carbon dioxide in Earth's atmosphere. Add in the fact that the average temperature of Mars is negative 81 degrees Fahrenheit, and you have a planet where humans cannot survive outside without a spacesuit. However, despite all of the hazards presented by the red planet, it is actually the most livable planet in the solar system besides our own. How so? Well, to begin, even though Mars is smaller than Earth, the surface area of the planet that you can stand on is nearly equivalent to the surface area that we can stand on here on Earth, because most of the Earth is covered by water. Additionally, a typical day on Mars looks very similar to a day on Earth, time-wise at least. A day on Mars is equivalent to a day on Earth plus 39 minutes. Seasons and years, though, are twice as long as Earth's. Gravity and calendar time aside, the ability to live on Mars all comes down to the same four essentials that we need to live on Earth, plus one more: food, water, shelter, clothing, and oxygen. Elon Musk argues, and NASA agrees, that all of these can be achieved on Mars.
Definitely sending people to Mars and living on Mars is feasible. There are technologies that we will need that have developed yet, but there's no showstoppers. There's things that we know how to do and we can do. We just have to learn to get the engineering technology working.
That's Jeffrey Landis. He's an aerospace engineer for NASA who focuses on planetary exploration, interstellar propulsion, and photovoltaics, or solar panels. He worked on many of the major landers and probes that explored Mars during the 1990s and 2000s.
I was pretty heavily involved in Mars exploration for quite a few years. I started with the Mars Pathfinder mission I was part of the Sojourner rover team, and our part on that mission actually was the solar energy, and most specifically, the dust coverage on the rover. We were measuring and modeling and trying to understand the deposition of the Martian dust onto the rover as it moved.
Landis is also a science fiction writer and a poet, and his work with NASA has informed his vision for what is possible for humans in the future of multiplanetary exploration. He says that the first step, sending mankind to Mars, is the easiest.
The hard part, though, is not sending people to Mars. The hard part is that we have to bring people back from Mars. And all the expeditions to Mars so far have been robots. It's not that robots are better at exploring. Robots aren't nearly as good as people at exploring. People are very versatile. But the robots don't have to come home. A fully fueled interplanetary launch vehicle that can launch from Mars and bring you back to Earth. That's the real trick. Launching from Earth is hard enough, but launching something from Earth that can launch from Mars and come back home really doesn't merely double the difficulty, it squares the difficulty. The technology, in fact, that I'm most excited about is working on that question, how do you bring people back? And the technology that you want is the ability to make rocket fuel on Mars, because sending a fully fueled mission to Mars is really tough. That's a lot of rocket fuel to launch from Mars, perhaps rendezvous with a ship in orbit, and then launch from Mars all the way back to Earth. If instead you can make rocket fuel when you get there, now you can send an empty tank return vehicle and just fill it up when you get there, and that makes it tremendously simpler. For a long time in the early 2000s, I worked on a project to demonstrate making rocket fuel on Mars. Our project was called MIP, the Mars ISPP precursor, where ISPP stands for In-Situ Propellant Production. We were working on the technologies to try to make oxygen on the planet Mars, because, of course, oxygen is the major component of rocket fuel. If you can make oxygen, you can make most of the weight of the rocket fuel you need.
The MIP project never flew. But by no fault of Landis or his team, in December 1999, a different project called the Mars Polar Lander crashed into Mars upon landing. Since Landis's project used the same spacecraft technology as the Polar Lander, authorities at NASA decided to scrap his mission. Luckily, Landis's experiment didn't die with the MIP project.
What I think is great is that the things that we were trying to do with the MIP project, which was aimed for launching in 2001, is now going to be done with the Mars Perseverance rover. So Perseverance, the Mars 2020 rover, it in fact has a experiment to try to make rocket fuel on Mars.
The Perseverance rover, which launched from Earth in July 2020, landed on Mars on February 18th, 2021, and will collect rock and soil samples to eventually be returned for study on Earth. It brings with it to the Red Planet a small helicopter that will demonstrate powered flight on another world for the first time. It will be the latest in a series of missions to Mars dating back to 1971, when NASA's Mariner 9 probe became the first artificial satellite to orbit Mars.
When the Mariner spacecraft first flew past Mars in the early 1960s, everybody was very disappointed. They said, oh, a very thin atmosphere, very cold, no liquid water. But the more recent Mars missions have been telling us more about the history of Mars, telling us that even though Mars is very cold and dry right now, in the past, Mars was a warm planet, or I don't know if you'd say warm, but certainly warmer than it is now, warm enough that it had liquid water on the surface. Definitely lakes and rivers, and some people are saying it may have even had an ocean. We're now learning enough about Mars that says, well, you know, maybe this is not a lifeless planet that's always been lifeless. It might be a very exciting place. It once had water, perhaps it even once had life. One of the big questions we have about the universe is, are we alone? Is life unique to Earth? On the one hand, you say, no, it's impossible. It can't be unique to Earth that we just have the one planet. But so far, this is the only planet that we know that's had life. So learning just that one other planet could sustain life would really tell us a lot about our place in the universe.
The question is, even if Mars did once have life, Can the planet support it now?
Well, certainly if we were going to have a mission to Mars that has a lot of people, perhaps is not merely visiting Mars but settling, yes, you're going to have to learn to grow food on Mars. There's no technical showstoppers to that. Agriculture is something humans have been doing for, what, perhaps 8,000 years. We know a lot about how to grow plants.
But how do you grow food in a frozen desert with little oxygen? To start, says science writer Stephen Petrenic, we'll be able to conduct hydroponics, a method of growing crops without soil. But even then, only about 20% of food on Mars could be grown this way, as the planet currently stands. The remainder would have to be shipped from Earth. Elon Musk and SpaceX, though, present a more long-term solution to this problem, compressing the planet's atmosphere. The company and its CEO posit that Mars's polar ice caps, which consist of frozen carbon dioxide, can be harnessed to create an intentional greenhouse effect. If humans were to place a solar sail in space, essentially a giant orbiting mirror, and aim it at one of the ice caps, the frozen CO2 would heat up enough to sublime, that is, transition directly from a solid to a gas, and enter the planet's atmosphere. The effect would be to insulate Mars by thickening the planet's atmosphere, resulting in warmer global temperatures, higher atmospheric pressure, the potential for precipitation, and protection of the surface from the solar and cosmic radiation with which it is currently bombarded. All of which would give humans a better chance of farming the Martian soil. However, Landis acknowledges that even that ambitious of a plan would not be a perfect fix.
I think perhaps there's a little bit underestimating the problems. It's not going to be as simple as just compressing the atmosphere. Plants don't merely need carbon dioxide. They need both carbon dioxide and oxygen to grow. So we're going to have to compress the oxygen. We're going to have to make oxygen from the Mars environment to allow them to grow in an oxygen and carbon dioxide atmosphere. We're going to certainly have to make sure that some of the plants are nitrogen fixing. So the plants are going to have the nitrogen-fixing bacteria that give them the nitrogen that's necessary to grow. But all of these are solvable problems. We're going to have to purify the Martian soil somewhat. Martian soil is very salty. Some of these salts are the perchlorate salts that probably you don't want to grow plants in. So we're going to have to, at a minimum, sort of wash out the salts out of the soil. You're probably going to want to make greenhouses. You can grow plants in a lower pressure than Earth atmospheric pressure, but you probably can't grow them in as low as Martian atmospheric pressure. So these greenhouses are going to have to sustain an atmospheric pressure on the inside that's going to tend to try to blow them apart. So they're going to have some pretty robust structure to keep the atmosphere in and keep the high pressure from rupturing. But again, you have to say, well, all these are engineering problems. We can solve these problems. They're not anything that is a showstopper. It's just a question of getting some very competent engineers to make these designs and start building them.
In fact, many of the engineering problems that must be overcome to live on Mars have already been solved. Take, for example, the issue of oxygen. At MIT, a scientist named Michael Hecht has designed a machine called the Mars Oxygen ISRU Experiment, MOXIE for short, which takes in carbon dioxide from the Martian atmosphere to produce pure oxygen, enough for one person to breathe indefinitely. Not only that, MOXIE was designed to be scalable by a factor of 100, and will be one of the instruments Perseverance tests during its mission.
Yeah, we can go Mars. We can do that. It would be a difficult project, but not an impossible project.
Landis is optimistic about the prospect of life on Mars, but many of the engineering solutions for life on Mars presuppose a successful manned landing on the planet. How far away is humanity's Neil Armstrong moment on the red planet? Centuries? Decades? NASA says that humans could be on Mars by the 2030s. Elon Musk says he can do it by 2026.
Discovery's four computers now have primary control of critical vehicle functions.
To send something into space, even just to Earth orbit, you need a rocket. And to send something to Mars, you need a really big one. To understand why, let's take a look at the Apollo 11 mission. After blasting off from Launch Complex 39A on July 16, 1969, it took Neil Armstrong, Buzz Aldrin, and Michael Collins just over 3 days to reach the moon, which is 250,000 miles away from the Earth. And that was using a Saturn V rocket, which still holds the title as the most powerful rocket ever launched. Mars, meanwhile, is 1,000 times farther away from the Earth than the moon at its closest. That's 250 million miles, which only occurs once every 2 years. This means that it takes even an incredibly powerful rocket 8 months to reach the fourth planet from the sun. When Elon Musk founded SpaceX, he had no such rocket. In fact, he had no rocket at all. That's because, in 2002, private companies in America didn't just build spacecraft and launch them. That was the work of NASA. Instead, a select number of private companies, namely Boeing and Northrop Grumman, served as contractors for the space agency, securing multi-billion dollar contracts through which they assembled the hardware for government-funded projects. SpaceX, therefore, was from the outset a serious underdog, designing and building its own rockets from scratch and operating by the principles of the free market. Derided and shrugged off by the likes of Boeing and Northrop Grumman, Musk brought his signature pluckiness to the operations of SpaceX, giving his young company the motto Gradatim Ferociter, which means step by step, ferociously, in Latin. It's a motto that both CEO and company have lived up to, with Musk going as far as to parade the company's first rocket, the Falcon 1, through the streets of Washington, D.C. on a flatbed truck in December 2003, even though the spacecraft hadn't actually flown yet. When SpaceX attempted the first launch of the Falcon 1 in March 2006, almost 2.5 years later, the rocket failed. But ferociously they went, brushing themselves off after the initial failure of the Falcon 1 to successfully launch the rocket into orbit in September 2008, becoming the first private company to send a liquid-fueled launch vehicle into orbit around the Earth. 3 months later, NASA awarded SpaceX a $1.6 billion contract to fly cargo to the International Space Station. 4 years after that, in May 2012, the company's Dragon spacecraft became the first commercial vehicle to reach the ISS. Driven by a combination of Musk's leadership, fiscal necessity, and the passion of its engineers, the milestones just kept coming for SpaceX. In December 2015, the company successfully landed the Falcon 9 rocket for the first time, an achievement that helps drive down the cost of spaceflight by allowing SpaceX to reuse the most expensive part of the rocket, the booster. As mentioned at the beginning of the program, the crowning achievement for SpaceX to date has been its two successful manned missions to the International Space Station in 2020, which safely delivered a total of 6 people to the orbiting space lab. But the ISS is far from being the finish line. Elon Musk's ultimate goal is, and has always been, Mars. On December 9th, 2020, SpaceX completed a high-altitude test of a prototype of Starship, the rocket the company plans to use to take humans to Mars. It's set to be the world's most powerful launch vehicle ever created, able to lift a payload in excess of 100 metric tons into Earth orbit. That's the equivalent of 100 1979 Volkswagen Beetles. Musk says that when Starship is ready to take humans to the Red Planet, a ticket aboard will cost $200,000. If that price sounds familiar, it's because that's how much Virgin Galactic is charging for a 5-minute flight just across the threshold of space.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
The story of SpaceX isn't one of constant linear progress. It's had its fair share of failures and setbacks, such as when the company's Falcon 9 rocket exploded during a launch to resupply the ISS in 2015. But it's also a story of defying odds and expectations, and overcoming failures to accelerate the speed and efficiency of human space exploration. It is no longer a question of if Elon Musk and his daring space company will be able to deliver humans to Mars, but when? Join me next time as I talk with David W. Brown, author of the new book, The Mission, about how Mars has always been the objective of American space exploration, even long before Elon Musk entered the space industry, as well as about the significance of another promising celestial body, Jupiter's smallest moon, Europa. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Rocket Launch Pod, a podcast from The Donut. A special thank you to Jeffrey Landis for appearing on the program, as well as to Peter Nowak, my producer, for his unwavering support for the project. I'd also like to thank the design team at The Donut for the amazing cover art they've created for the program. I'd also like to say a special thank you to the Mr. Fix-It cell phone and computer repair shop in Charlottesville, Virginia. The laptop I was using to edit this podcast crashed before I backed it up, and despite my worst fears, the team at Mr. Fix-It was graciously able to restore all of my files. Thank you to them, and to listeners, please do yourself a favor and go back up your files. Audio for this episode came from the NASA Audio Archives, the Ronald Reagan Foundation, the CBS News Archives, and SpaceX. Additional information for this podcast came from the book The Space Barons by Christian Davenport, The Smithsonian History of Space Exploration by Roger Lanius, and from Stephen Petronick's TED Talk, Your Kids Might Live on Mars, Here's How They'll Survive. If you're interested in learning more about the history of the space race and the Apollo missions, check out the Moonrise podcast from the Washington Post. I'm Nate Ray, and I'll see you next time.
So now everybody's excited. Everybody wants to learn about Mars. What was this planet like? What happened? It's an interesting planet.